From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a little boy. And before I tell you more about this boy, I'll share that this hour's conversation includes themes that may be difficult for some listeners, especially children. So listen at your own discretion. The boy I mentioned was born in a strawberry patch in Grand River Territory in Ontario, Canada. When he was about 3 years old, he was forcibly taken from his family and placed in a residential school for Native American children. The school, called the Mohawk Institute, was the longest operating residential school in Canada. It was run by the Anglican Church. According to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, about 15,000 children were forced to attend that institute from 1831 to 1970, and many, like the boy, were physically and sexually abused, forced to do hard labor, and faced malnutrition. Students called it the mush hole for the poor quality of food that they were served. Their hair was cut, their clothes were burned, they were given new English names and forced to abandon indigenous languages. Some students never returned to their families. Others died. The motto of residential schools was, "Kill the Indian in the child." The boy in question spent 11 years at the Mohawk Institute, and while he physically escaped, the mental trauma of that experience has stayed with him, as you might understand. Now in his adulthood, he's an artist, and 40 years after leaving the school, he began making art about his experience. Some of that work is on display at the Rochester Contemporary Art Center in an exhibition called Our Path Forward. If you're not familiar with residential schools like the Mohawk Institute, this hour is meant to inform you about those facilities and the cultural suppression and erasure for which they have been responsible. Canada has publicly acknowledged the schools as committing cultural genocide and formally apologized in 2008. In the United States, acknowledgement has been slower. In this country, hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced into boarding schools for more than 150 years. There were more than 500 such schools, and the majority of them received federal funding. Last month, the U.S. Department of the Interior issued a report that stated nearly 1,000 American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian children died while attending boarding schools set up by the U.S. government, and the report called on the U.S. government to formally apologize, as Canada has done. There's a lot to talk about this hour, including the story of the artist we mentioned. His name is Gary Miller, and Gary is with us on the line. Gary, we are grateful to have you joining us this hour. Thank you for being with us.
Yes, and thank you for having me.
Welcome in studio to Dr. Neil Keating. Neil is curator of Our Path Forward. He's an author, associate professor of cultural anthropology at SUNY Brockport. Thank you for being here as well, Neil.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And I want to mention that the exhibit that we're talking about is showing at the Rochester Contemporary Art Center, ROCO, through Sunday, Neil, yes?
Sunday, yes.
Why do you want the public to see this particular exhibit?
I'd love the public to come see the exhibit to learn more about the history of residential schools, because many, many citizens of both Canada and the United States grow up without any knowledge whatsoever of these institutions that spread throughout North America.
What has some of the response that you've seen been to this kind of work?
Well, it varies. So this work has been seen by other survivors who understand the art right away because it speaks to their own experiences. And there are tens of thousands of survivors that are still with us today. The responses of settler citizens is often one of just amazement that I didn't know that this was going on.
I want to mention as well to listeners, we had, in advance of this program, we had mentioned that Michael Galbin was going to be with us. He's a historian. He's a historic site manager of Ganundagan, curator of the Seneca Art and Culture Center. Michael had to cancel late this morning, and so sorry to not have him with us, but hope to talk to Michael about this subject on a future program. We always appreciate his insight. Gary, let me start by asking you a little bit about yourself now. How are you these days? And tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing now.
Okay, well, I'm a professional artist as we speak. I my subject matter is just about any subject there is, but I'm basically a landscape oil painter as well as a portrait painter. And most of my subjects are of Native ancestry.
Gary, do you...
I'm sorry, go ahead, Gary.
Yep, go ahead.
Yes, I've been fortunate enough to be in several collections across the United States and Canada, basically just for the portraits themselves and the landscapes, but more the portraiture than anything. And I was taught by a very good friend of mine who's quite a well-known painter, and I've just carried it on. And as a young person, starting from the residential school, recognition by the Holman School in Brantford, and then I went on to the Ontario College of Art, and then from there, my profession blossomed under friendships and tutelage with Mr. Tom Hodgson, which is one of the Painters 11, and some of his associates. And I shared studio space with them. And again, through their critiques constantly happening and whatnot, and I learned at a scale a little faster than if I were doing it alone. And I owe them a debt of gratitude as well.
Gary, when you speak to non-Indigenous Americans or Canadians, do you find that they have any knowledge of residential schools like the Mohawk Institute?
Could you repeat that just for me, please? I didn't realize my son's phone was ringing.
Oh, no problem. No problem. Okay. Let me repeat that question for you, Gary.
And I
want Neil to weigh in on this as well. Gary, when you speak to non-Indigenous Americans and Canadians, do you find that they typically have any knowledge about residential schools like the Mohawk Institute?
Some do in the Eastern Seaboard. However, when I went to the Los Angeles Museum in Los Angeles, they knew next to nothing about residential schools or the fact that the government had passed the responsibility and the discipline, et cetera, to the churches. So both Catholic and Anglican, and I'm not sure, probably Protestant as well. But being an Anglican, I was in particular sent to the Mohawk Institute, which is on and lies on Six Nations territory. And being a Mohawk from Six Nations, that's where I went at the age of 3. And it was only after serving there and going to high school that I had learned that residential schools were right across the country and many in the United States. And some famous, like Tom Longboat and The Runner and others, went to the Carlisle Indian School, and I knew nothing about that. So it was very informative for me to learn that we didn't get away. They got us in both countries and stuck us in these places. I guess you could say it was the defeathering of an Indian, so to speak. It was to take us and turn us into white Indians. You know, the fear of God and the Anglican and Catholic Church and what have you, and the denial of our own language and the denial of our own heritage and traditional beliefs. So later in life, here I am, trying to catch up and trying to learn more about my own culture as though I was a non-Indian trying to learn about my culture, basically in the same shoes. However, I am allowed in ceremonies and I'm allowed in places where no one else other than an Indian or Mohawk or Cayuga or any of the Six Nations can go to in these longhouses. It is because becoming a little less stringent today, and mainly because of the bell curve on the coming downside. There is so much of a loss of our language that fewer and fewer Native people, as you're growing up, don't have the ability to speak it. And to go to a longhouse, the only language spoken is the indigenous language of the Six Nations, whether it be Cayuga, Onondaga, Mohawk, Oneida, etc. That's, you know, anyone can go in, but they really don't know what's being said. And I, on the other hand, have a very limited understanding as to what's being said. But I do, because my dad spoke to me when I finally got out of the, as we call it, the mush hole. And the reason it was called the mush hole was we were served mush 364 days of the year. And it was a hole. Literally, we hated it. But there are friendships, you know, even in your prisons, there are friendships that you know, form. In residential schools, you have Indians from all over Ontario coming together in one little space, one little residential school. And in the Mohawk Institute, there would be about 75 to 80 girls and the same number in the boys' side. And from Cree, Ojibwe, to Mohawk, and the Six Nations, Oneida, Tuscarora, Cayuga, et cetera. And, yeah, and basically the same thing that you would get in reform school. You basically have to earn your place. And usually that starts out in fighting. You know, you had to basically fight your way to not only acceptance, but to a certain status within the residential school system.
Talking to Gary Miller, and I want to make sure listeners understand, when we talk about residential schools, for the better part of 150 years, many schools had the motto of kill the Indian in the child. So when Gary is talking about not knowing, you know, really his own language, and we talk about loss of language, loss is a real problem. We've talked to different guests on this program throughout the years who come from indigenous backgrounds, and some have a lot of their sort of heritage and language, and some do not. And that was part of the goal here. It was part of the goal in these schools to kill the language, to kill the culture, the traditions, the historical knowledge. And so Gary is talking about some of how that was done, and some of what he experienced starting at the age of three when he was taken to one of the residential schools. Let me ask Dr. Neil Keating, who's curator of this exhibit at ROCO, Our Path Forward, which is running through Sunday, and an associate professor of cultural anthropology at SUNY Brockport. Most non-Indigenous Americans, Canadians that you talk to, if this subject comes up, how much knowledge do you think people have of residential schools?
I think the knowledge is starting to grow among the public in Canada. And that has to do with the recent National Truth and Reconciliation reports, as well as several other reports documenting what happened in these schools and also the intergenerational impacts. So the knowledge about residential schools is growing in Canada. In the United States, it's close to zero at this point. And my sense of that is that the reason why no one knows about these, even though there were hundreds of these institutions all throughout the United States, here in New York State, all the way to the West Coast and throughout Canada, is because both the settler states of the U.S. and Canada have worked hard to maintain a veil of silence around these institutions.
It's intentional.
I believe it's intentional.
Why do you think the goal is for school children? I don't think I could be wrong. I think I learned nothing about this in my schooling growing up. Why do you think the goal is for kids not to learn?
I think it has a lot to do with the goals of the settler states, which are to eliminate Native people from the landscape. And so residential schools was one of the techniques for eliminating people from that. And that means erasing them, erasing their identity, erasing their national identity in particular, erasing them as peoples and assimilating them into Canadian mainstream society or American mainstream society. So as part of that erasure is, let's not talk about what's going on. Let's not talk about the techniques that are being used to eliminate Native peoples as peoples.
Neil, in some way, even in some small way, do you think exhibits like Our Path Forward start to undo some of that either miseducation or lack of education?
Yes, I think that it can help to transform public consciousness and build greater awareness of what has really happened in our country. And to me, this is very important for moving forward. As the title of the exhibit says, we have to move forward together as a people with open minds and with good understanding. That's the only way that we can build a better country, whether we're talking about the United States or Canada or Australia or New Zealand, which have similar histories.
The exhibit featuring some of Gary Miller's work, again, showing through Sunday at the Rochester Contemporary Arts Center. Let me take a phone call from Paul in Brighton. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I would like to make a comment about whether your guest or anyone has heard about heard a place in Phoenix, Arizona. It is actually called the Heard Museum, H-E-A-R-D. It specializes in indigenous or Native American art. And since the year 2000, they've had an exhibit there called Away From Home, American Indian Boarding School Stories. And I visited Phoenix this past May and went to this museum. And this the exhibit is absolutely incredible. And, you know, as you say, talk about information that people may not have ever been aware of. Just incredible. The things that went on there and, but as I say, I would encourage anybody who might be listening today and even your guests, if they're not aware of the Heard Museum, to take a look at this exhibit and the educational components that are on the website for the museum, because I think it might add a lot to, whoever is listening today might want to, if they want to learn some more, this might be a great spot to go.
Paul, and thank you.
I will go off the air now.
Yeah, sure. Paul, thank you for the phone call. I mean, it's certainly art has a way of telling stories, educating, filling in gaps that are there, sometimes intentionally, as we were hearing this hour. And that's often the story of residential schools, this really awful, tragic, painful history that a lot of non-Indigenous Americans and Canadians are just not educated about. And Paul, what you're describing about the gallery in Phoenix, I think, on the Heard exhibit, I think Rocco's trying to do the same kind of thing, the same kind of mission here. I don't know if you're aware of what Paul was talking about, Neil.
Yes, there are several exhibitions about residential schools or boarding schools that have been created in Canada and the U.S. in the last 20 years. Not too many, but certainly the exhibit at the Heard Museum is a very substantial exhibit. So I agree with Paul. If you have a chance, go see it. Check out the website. What's different about this exhibit is that this is art created by a survivor. So it's first-person art about his experience. All of the other exhibitions about boarding schools and residential schools are largely based on documentary evidence, photographs, and accounts from the children and their grandchildren of survivors. So this exhibit is quite unique in so far as it presents the first-person voice of a survivor through art.
Gary Miller is that artist. He's on the line with us. And Gary, let me just ask you, what is your most vivid memory of the Mohawk Institute?
Sexual abuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awful.
When I was five. And what was remains in my mind the most is for 2 hours every Sunday, we would be marched, the girls in front of the boys in a lineup of twos from the residential school to the Mohawk Chapel, and where we were preached to with stories from the Bible and what have you, and how fortunate we are to have been found and put into a renewal education format, and we should be thankful for all of these things. And much of this, as I said, was a defeathering of the Indian, because when we did go home, and in my case, the Mohawk Institute is right on Six Nations territory, and when I go home and go to the longhouse, I have to sit and I see what's going on, and somebody has to, either one of my uncles or what have you, sit beside me and tell me what's being said, because I didn't have a clue. But at least I was fortunate enough to come from a longhouse family, and there are many families at Six Nations who are totally indoctrinated into the Christian faith, and they pretty much have churches throughout there, you know, teaching us about the white man's God and what have you, Jesus, and the story of creation. And it differs from ours. And being in the Mohawk Institute, there was an influx of natives coming down from Moose Factory and Moosonee and Attawapiskat and all throughout Eastern Ontario, and sometimes even from West Winnipeg, and from the far east past Montreal and all the way down to the Mi'kmaq territory of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And they would all be there. And it was an interesting mix, because it's the residential school, as I seen it, it was an acceptable punishment, if you will, and the indoctrinating us into the Christian faith. But more importantly, we like to get into fights, and we were jealous because from Six Nations, they've been defeathering us and taking away our language and our faith since the 17th century, and many of us couldn't speak our language. And although I understand a lot more than I can speak, I still have a very, very foggy. And since my father passed away, it's even getting less and less, to the point I have to admit that I am not linguistically knowledgeable of my own language or that of any other of the five nations that's at Six Nations. And my mother is a Mohawk and my father is a Cayuga. And being a matriarchal society, then I would be of the Wolf clan, my mother's clan, and I would follow my mother, because the Iroquois people are a matriarchal society. And much of this I had to learn after I left the Mohawk Institute.
Gary, you tried to escape a number of times from school?
Oh, yes. Yes. I would imagine over a period of 11 years, I probably 6 to 8 times, maybe. Yeah. And we didn't know it. We just followed the tracks as long as we got away. And it was a marvel to go down the roads of unknown areas and look up at the sky and see the stars on a cloudless night. It was just an experience in its own, and there was a freedom there. And the first time, we didn't know what was going to happen to us, but after you've run away a few times, you know what kind of punishment you were going to get. And let me tell you, it was well worth it. You know, they'd bend us over a chair, and they used to cut the straps that go around the tractors, and they would make straps out of that big rubber leather mixing with metal in it, and they'd make straps out of that. Like you'd bend over a bench or, and they'd jump and be trying to hit you so hard in the rear and bare bottom and miss it and hit you in the legs and in the back, and they just kept on doing it. And if you tried not to cry, they would just keep doing it. And it slowly eased up a little because many of us had to go to the nurse with infections and what have you, and the welts wouldn't go away. They turned into bruises all over our backs and legs and hands and arms. And I would say that in the residential school structure itself, the nurses were the most understanding and the most helpful to us. And many of them would take down our family's numbers and get a hold of them and inform them as to what's going on there. Because not many people really know just how bad it is and was, especially at the Mohawk Institute. I mean, sexual abuse was, I was sexually abused for 5 years, starting at the age of five. And I was sexually abused by a minister that would fondle children in the nighttime and then teach and preach on Sunday in front of us for 2 hours. Mm. So how confusing was that? Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, and then we'd go home, if we're lucky, for the summer, and then we would attend the Longhouse. And basic premise in the Longhouse is to give thanks. Thanks for everything. It's whatever festival, whether it be the strawberry festival or the corn husk and everything. It was just thanking the Creator. And what I found, at least when I went to the Mohawk Chapel, was give, you know. People putting money in the things, and it seemed to be the big difference. And we never really listened as to what was going on, because the same people that were preaching to us would prowl our dorms at night, picking us and taking us by hand to their room to sexually abuse us.
Terrible.
In all manner you can think about.
Oh, Gary. Let me do this here. I want to let our listeners know we're going to take a little bit more feedback. I want to remind you, we're talking about some really heavy and difficult subjects this hour, but these are necessary conversations, especially in a country, as I've said, that, and as our guests have said, that either unintentionally or intentionally has not taught these stories, the stories of residential boarding schools that were intentionally designed for nearly 150 years to kill the Indian in the child. That was the motto. You heard Gary Miller, one of our guests, talk about, in his words, defeathering. The intention was clear, really sort of horrific stuff. And Canada formally apologized about 15 years ago. We're going to take our only break. And when we come back from our only break, I want to take a phone call. We'll take Trish in Rochester. So hang there, Trish. I'll take your call on the other side of this break. I've got some more feedback from listeners. Want you to know that you can see Gary's work at Rochester Contemporary Art Center through Sunday. The exhibition, it's called Our Path Forward. And I know that they would really appreciate you getting a chance to see Gary's work as an artist. He is an artist, the former child inmate of the Mohawk Institute, telling his story here and through his work. Dr. Neil Keating is with us. Neil is curator of Our Path Forward. He is an author and a professor of cultural anthropology at SUNY Brockport. This is our only break, and we'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Thursday, it's a live edition of Connections, a special edition with a live audience. We're at the Summit for RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. And we're talking in both hours about the decades-long effort to eliminate or dramatically reduce poverty in Rochester and in the surrounding area, why that's been such a struggle, and we'll talk to people who've experienced poverty. That's Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Trish in Rochester on the phone. Hi, Trish. Go ahead.
Hi there. I want to thank Rocco and Blue for putting on this show, and Neil for working with Gary on it, and most of all, thanking Gary for sharing his artwork with us. The art stands on its own. I encourage everyone to go see it because he's just a fantastically talented artist. And but then what you will learn and glean from it is incredible. I think more than reading about the residential schools or boarding schools or going to a museum, because you see some of Gary's soul on the canvases. And I think, you know, the schools tried to kill his soul, but clearly they did not. They may have certainly done their damage, but he has survived, and with his art, he has thrived. So I thank him for all that he's given us. I strongly encourage, I love the name of it, Our Path Forward. It's a great name because it is our path. And when I say our, I'm not talking about Indigenous people entirely. I'm talking about everyone, because it may have been the Indigenous people who suffered, but it was other people who committed that suffering. And so it is their path as well that they should walk on and review this history. And especially the Catholic Diocese of Rochester, which I sent a personal invitation out to, but I haven't heard anything back. So I would love for some people from the church to view the show and learn from it. And most importantly, I want to say that these never should have been called schools, whether they were residential on the Canadian side or boarding on the American side. Schools was not the name for them. They were, I love Neil and Gary's terminology. They were prison camps. They were brutal. They were labor camps, free labor, and military camps. They were training Indigenous children to be fodder for the United States military. And more people should know about this history, because it is their history as well as Indigenous history. But on a more positive note, I would love for people to honor the children who survived, as well as honor the children who didn't, and join Indigenous Peoples Day in an event that this will be the third year we're holding it, and we're honoring all the children on both sides of the border on all of Turtle Island that had to survive or experience boarding schools. On the 28th, on Saturday the 28th, we're gathering at 10 o'clock at Lake Riley, and we're walking up Cobbs Hill Reservoir to where we planted the White Pine Tree of Peace on Indigenous Peoples Day. And we'll have a few speakers, and we would love for people to show their support and gather and join us on that day. And then, of course, come out and join us at Genesee Valley Park on Indigenous Peoples Day in October and learn more about the people whose land everyone is living on and working on and profiting from. And so we'd love for people to gain even more history. But most of all, I want to thank Gary for what he's put on canvas, and for Neil for supporting this project, and Blue for bringing it to Rochester. Nyawe.
Thank you, Trish. Appreciate that phone call. Anything you want to add, Neil?
Yeah, I would like to add that that this exhibit, because of the nature of it, is very powerful and can be upsetting to some visitors. So part of the design of the exhibit was to create what we're calling a breathing space within the exhibit itself, which is a space for visitors to process what they've seen, to take a moment to sit and think about what they've seen. And so this space has been designed by Lauren Jimerson, who's a Cattaraugus Seneca and a resident of Rochester and also an art therapist. And so the space has proven to be incredibly important to showing the art by providing that place for visitors to just breathe, to help them to understand and think about what they've seen.
Thanks again, Trish, for that phone call. David writes to us from Vancouver. He says, a good friend of mine from Ontario was also forced to be at that same horrific school. My friend tells me that he escaped at around 12 years old and lived on the streets of Toronto and St. Catharines, Ontario. That is from David. And Tess says, most of the art in the exhibit was black and white, with striking use of the color red. Reminded me of the little girl in the red coat in Schindler's List, but I'm thinking red has particular resonance when we're talking about indigenous people in the Americas. Can Gary talk about his use of red? That's from Tess. Go ahead, Gary. What do you think?
To be honest, I did the artwork, and I didn't want to use an entire spectrum of color, but the whole idea of red skins and red, plus it's a bold color. It's one of the strongest hues in the spectrum. And a lot of the work is in pencil. It's in black and white. And the best contrast that I could find was red. And also it goes along with the red skin idea of us all being red skins. Mm-hmm. Almost to the point where later we would talk to each other and call each other skins. I mean, while they were using it in a, I don't know whether you'd say it was an insult or what have you, but it certainly wasn't for our praise. But we, when we spoke to each other, would call each other skins. And we just turned it around. And, yeah, the use of red, it just was, I would say, more by subliminal accident than a direct choice of the color. But once I did it, I found that it worked. And the black and white, it contrasted more. Basically, my experiences and memories are in either a kaleidoscope of color, or it's very simple in black and white. And when I was trying to inform as well as educate about our experiences as children in the Mohawk Institute and other residential schools, which I know little about, but I just basically know about the mush hole. Hmm. And the reason we call it the mush hole, and I may be repeating myself, but it's 364 days a year we got mush, usually overcooked, very sticky, but you either had to like it or go hungry.
Go hungry, yeah.
And there wasn't many days we didn't go hungry. Hmm. And later, there's a story about the dump. I don't know if we have time or whatever, but...
No. We need to hear this history here. The floor is yours, Gary. Tell us the story.
Well, okay. The Mohawk Chapel was down the end of the lane, still on the Institute property, which is all on Six Nations land anyway. But just across the pasture was the city dump. Now, why they would dump on Indian land is beyond me, but there was the dump. And in Brantford, there is a factory called Weston's Candies, and they used to throw out a lot of improperly wrapped taffy candies, Halloween candies, other different types of jelly and whatnot, and throw them in the dump. Well, we would go scrounging through the dump for unopened old cans or past due cans of peaches and things like that, and we'd hunt for candy. And we didn't, you know, we just wash off the white powder that was on it. And I believe later we found that was rat poison or what have you. And we didn't care. We just washed it off in the creek and got our candy that way. And we hide it in the cornfields and boxes and what have you. But because we never got much money, you know, many of our parents never showed up to visit us. And if they did, they'd give us a dollar, which would have to last us until the next year or whatever. But yeah, and I was sort of an in-betweener. I was so young, I was too young to be put to work in milking the cows and feeding the chicks and what have you. And we always thought it was games. And riding the pigs can be dangerous, but we used to do things like that. And the older kids would have to milk the cows and call the hog, the cows in and place the big blocks of blue salt in the pastures and what have you. And anything, we would do anything to get away from the macho. And we didn't care about the strap, but we didn't care, you know, like that. The punishment that we went through was in the head. And believe me, you know, the whiskey drinking Indian or the Indian, you can stop just about any one of them in Toronto or any other major city, Vancouver, Montreal, wherever. There's a populace and everyone looks down. Look at that drunken Indian. Look at that. If they walked in that Indian's shoes, they'd damn well be drunk too.
Yeah. Let me read an email from Rick. Rick says, Evan, the first time I met an Indigenous person was in 1979 when I worked at Oberlin College. I remember being astounded, even skeptical, that my colleague was truly an Indigenous person, because having grown up in New York City, I was taught that Indigenous people no longer existed. So I truly had no meaningful knowledge about the native peoples of this continent. I appreciate the efforts to help us become better educated about the culture and history of Indigenous peoples. And art is an excellent way to pursue that education, at least as one step in the process. Do your guests see any parallels to what was done to Indigenous people and today's efforts to squelch DEI initiatives? I wonder how much the efforts to ignore or otherwise deny the cultures of those who are not descendants of European settlers is similar to what the Mohawk Institute and other schools like it did. That's from Rick. Let me start by asking Neil Keating to weigh in on that question. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I think there's a direct connection in terms of silencing. So, you know, efforts to silence Black history, for example, have many parallels with efforts to silence Indigenous histories. And again, this is part of maintaining the United States as a white possession. And so not all Americans agree with that. And that's been part of the strength of this country, is that there are those that think of democracy and freedom as something that should be universal for everybody, including Indigenous peoples, including Black people, including brown people, including women. And so there's a lot of work that is ongoing now with regards to unsilencing and telling the realities of what has happened in this country as a way of, again, of moving forward together.
Well, and then what might change some of that? Suzanne wants to know what the guests think about a formal American apology, as Canada has done. So I'll start with Neil. I'll ask both of our guests about this. My understanding is the government of Canada formally apologized for these residential schools. And I think, as our guest, as Trish said earlier, really is they were prison camps. Canada apologized back in 2007, 2008. Do you want to see the United States government apologize formally, Neil?
I think that's part of repairing the damage that's been done, but it's not enough. The apology has to come with meaningful action. And so what that consists of, first and foremost, is understanding the scope and the scale and the impact of American Indian boarding schools that it's had. And then from there is we need to have discussions about how do we strengthen Indigenous communities in the United States today. So one way of thinking about that is to revitalize Indigenous languages. And so there are many different groups across the continent that are engaged in revitalization programs centering on the language. And that's one good place to start. As we heard from Gary, you know, this is one of the losses that came out of his experience in the Mushall. And that loss is shared by tens of thousands of other Indigenous peoples in Canada and the United States. And that's one good way to start repairing the damage that's been done.
Gary, do you want to see the United States government formally apologize for this?
Yes, if it's meaningful and if they really mean it. And far too often, and I always think that the federal government in the United States pass a lot of their problems onto the states. Each different state basically deals with their problems, whether it's with Indigenous peoples or any other peoples that they've brought to the country under duress in the past. And I believe that many of them mean it and many of them don't. And it's very, very hard. And as Neil may have suggested to you, that actions mean a lot more than words. Saying you're sorry is very nice. It's a very good start. But showing you're sorry by undoing some of the reckless and very destructive, I would call it the stealing of our souls in many ways, because many of us no longer speak the language. We no longer have that connection to the Creator. So we go home and we go in search of it. And then many more of us end up in urban centers where it's far easier to do drugs and drink and to escape. And because they go home. And when they go home after being in a residential school, they can't hunt. They can't even speak their own language. So their own people turn their backs on them. They say, you know, they speak to them in Cree or Ojibwe or Mohawk, and they don't know how to respond. So they basically turn their backs in a way. So where do these children who are now men and women, where do they go? They migrate to the urban centers. And where do they do there? They congregate together, and they lose their souls in sorrow, drinking in bars and not knowing how to handle it. Now, non-natives, white people, let's say, how many years have they been used to drinking alcohol since before Christ? 2,000 plus years. How many years have the Aboriginal people of North America been in the alcohol experience? 150 years? So is it any wonder that they have absolutely no control or the alcohol eats their minds and makes them self-violent and brings back the punishments and all of the ill that has been done to them, and they turn it back out, and they don't care because they're already part of them. Their soul is dead already. That's been taken from them as they were young children in residential schools.
We've had really the privilege this hour of talking to Gary Miller, an artist whose work is on display now, a former child inmate of the Mohawk Institute, and his work on display at ROCO, Rochester Contemporary Art Center, through this Sunday. The exhibit is called Our Path Forward. And I want to ask Neil Keating to share some final thoughts. What do you want to leave with listeners as we think about better understanding this history and understanding the experiences of people like Gary, Neil?
Well, just to know that there are many groups of Indigenous peoples that are working in parallel with the efforts behind this exhibit. So, for example, the Mushhole Building and Grounds was reclaimed by Indigenous peoples in 1970. And within the last 10 years, they made a decision. They polled the members of their community with a basic question about the Mushhole Building and Grounds. Should we save the evidence or should we burn it to the ground? Many residential schools, many boarding schools in North America have been destroyed by either the former inmates or the children of the former inmates. But a choice was made at Six Nations to save the evidence. And so as we speak right now, the former Mohawk Institute is being converted into a site of conscience, similar to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And so Gary's art will be traveling to the Woodland Center in 2025 as part of that grand reopening. So so although the effort was made to eliminate Native peoples from the landscape, that effort did not entirely succeed. And so Native people are still here and are, in fact, are resisting and repudiating the settler colonialism that has caused so much problems in the past.
The exhibit in Rochester until Sunday. Our Path Forward, Neil Keating is the curator, the professor of cultural anthropology at SUNY Brockport. Thank you for being here this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Gary Miller, the artist whose work you can find there and telling his story. I know it is not easy, but Gary, thank you for making time for the program.
And thank you for allowing me to speak.
You got it. Again, everything's out at Roco for you to see through Sunday. From all of us here at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.